It is Monday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump gives his first TV interview since winning the presidency, and also generates controversy with one of his new picks for top White House advisor. Trump has his first phone call with China's president. We'll speak to an analyst about Beijing's thoughts on a Trump presidency. A journalist in Paris tells us why European leaders and NATO have reacted with concern to Trump's election victory, and will preview a new American movie about a true and groundbreaking story of interracial love. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has made his first White House appointments, naming a Washington insider as his chief of staff and a right-wing populist as his chief strategist. The Republican picked his party's national chairman, Reince Priebus, for the chief of staff post on Sunday, a choice that reassured many of the Republican leaders who control Congress. But Trump's decision to make his campaign chief, Stephen Bannon, his top White House strategist has generated sharp criticism from Democrats and even some Republicans. Before joining the Trump campaign in its final months, Bannon headed the Breitbart News website, which he once described as an alt-right or anti-establishment platform. Critics have condemned Breitbart for occasionally publishing articles that they say promote white nationalism and even anti-Semitism. We'll have more on that in a moment. But first, Trump also is in the spotlight for making his first detailed response to days of nationwide protests against his win. He sat down for an interview with U.S. network CBS's 60 Minutes program last Friday, and host Leslie Stahl asked him what he thinks of protesters who fear his presidency will suppress the rights of minorities.
That's only because they don't know me. I really believe that. That's only
because they listen to you in the campaign, and that's...
I just don't think they know me.
What do you think they're demonstrating against?
Well, I think in some cases you have professional protesters, and we had it... if you look at WikiLeaks, we
had... You think those people down there are...
Well, Leslie... Yeah, I think some of them will be professional.
Okay,
yeah, look,
but what about, in every city. When they demonstrate against you and there are signs out there, I mean, don't you say to yourself, I guess you don't, you know, do I have to worry about this? Do I have to go out and assuage them? Do I have to tell them not to be afraid? They're afraid.
I would tell them don't be afraid, absolutely.
But that's not what you're saying. I said it.
Oh, I think I'm saying it. I've been saying it.
Okay.
Don't be afraid.
I want to ask you all about something that's going on right now around the country. A lot of people are afraid. They're really afraid. African Americans think there's a target on their back. Muslims are terrified.
I think it's horrible if that's happening. I think it's built up by the press because, frankly, they'll take every single little incident that they can find in this country, which could have been there if I weren't even around doing this, and they'll make it into an event because that's the way the press is.
Well, 60 Minutes host Stahl also brought up the issue of immigration and Trump's vow to block undocumented migrants from entering the country.
Are you really going to build a wall?
Yes.
They're talking about a fence in the Republican Congress. Would you accept a fence?
For certain areas, I would, but certain areas, the wall is more appropriate. I'm very good at this. It's called construction. But
so part wall,
fence
part
be,
fence?
Yeah, it could be some fencing.
What about the pledge to deport millions and millions of undocumented immigrants?
What we are going to do is get the people that are criminal and have criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. We have a lot of these people, probably 2 million. It could even be 3 million. We're getting them out of our country or we're going to incarcerate. But we're getting them out of our country. They're here illegally. After the border is secured and after everything gets normalized, we're going to make a determination on the people that you're talking about, who are terrific people. They're terrific people. But we're going to make a determination at that. But before we make that determination, Leslie, it's very important. We want to secure our border.
All right, well, it's time for a check of social media, and Andrew Palchewski joins me in the studio. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
So we've just heard from some excerpts from Donald Trump's appearance on 60 Minutes. How are people responding to that on social media?
Well, there are a lot of moments in that interview that people talked about on social media, the comments we just heard about building the wall, some people saying that he's backtracking on what he promised in the campaign, saying now that he could build a fence in some areas. But one thing that I was struck by was how he talked about Facebook and Twitter, saying that he was going to use this to reach out to people and connect directly with them and with the huge audiences that he has on social media.
Something a bit unusual. I mean, Obama has a Twitter account, but doesn't use it quite in the same way that Trump does.
No, that's to say the least. And in fact, Donald Trump's already getting in a bit of trouble tweeting out about the New York Times losing subscribers, about professional protesters that are out in cities railing against his presidency. So he's already using it in a very interesting way. We'll see if he keeps that up or if that kind of has to be edited as he assumes the presidency. But the other big Trump news on social media was his appointment over the weekend of RNC Chairman Reince Priebus as chief of staff. And Steve Bannon, the executive editor of Breitbart, very conservative website, as his senior advisor. And so this has gotten a lot of play, the kind of the two appointments playing off each other. A lot of people...
Good cop, bad cop, perhaps?
Kind of. You know, people were relieved that Reince Priebus, a more mainstream Republican, was appointed chief of staff, but then very concerned about Steve Bannon, who has said some very controversial things, very hateful speech, according to some, in the past on this Breitbart website and in other places. So it is kind of this play back and forth on social media and what these two appointments will mean.
Yeah, I mean, Reince Priebus, I've seen him on the networks today pushing back against some of this criticism of Steve Bannon as an anti-Semite, saying that's not the man that I know. Has there been any response to that on social media?
Well, I think it's a lot of questions still. People are reacting to this and people are concerned about the appointment, but they're just waiting to see how this plays out. The other big story that we saw over the weekend, other than Donald Trump, was Hillary Clinton. But it wasn't actually Hillary Clinton. It was comedian Kate McKinnon. Kate McKinnon portraying her on Saturday Night Live in a tribute to Leonard Cohen, the songwriter who passed away this week, singing Hallelujah at the piano, Leonard Cohen's favorite song. That got a lot of people reacting on social media, a lot of people tearing up over that tribute.
Very emotional.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for that roundup. If you want to find Andrew on Twitter, he is at APAL, and I'm at Michael_Lippin. Here are some of the top stories right now on voanews.com. U.S. President Obama departs Monday on the final planned foreign trip of his presidency, with President-elect Trump expected to be a big topic of Obama's talks in Greece, Germany, and Peru. Germany's ruling coalition agrees on Steinmeier as president. Bulgaria's newly elected president is a Russia-friendly political novice. Strong aftershocks hit New Zealand following major quake. And Iraqi civilians in Islamic State-controlled Mosul tell of execution, beatings, and fear of the future. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. This is International Edition. China's President Xi Jinping has congratulated U.S. President-elect Donald Trump for his election victory in a Monday phone call. Chinese state media reported that both men agreed to maintain close contact, establish a good working relationship, and hold an early meeting. During the U.S. election campaign, Trump highlighted China's huge trade surplus with the U.S. and accused Beijing of unfair trade practices, including currency manipulation. Joseph Cheng is a China analyst and a retired City University of Hong Kong professor. Cheng told my colleague Victor Beatty that Trump's election has injected uncertainty into the calculations of Chinese leaders.
Chinese leaders since the Ronald Reagan campaign in 1980 have been trying to avoid commenting on election campaigns, as well as not to make any guesses, any assessments. And this practice has even been followed by Beijing's mainstream foreign policy think tank researchers. Chinese leaders argue that whatever is being said by the politicians and the campaigns are not important, because once they assume the position of president, they have to face the reality. They have to handle Sino-American relations carefully. Basically, President Xi is repeating his fundamental nine, that China wants to have good relations with the United States, that China wants to establish a new type of major power relationship with the United States avoiding confrontations, emphasizing on mutual interests, and trying to manage their differences, their disputes.
Do you think that they view Mr. Trump as different from President Obama?
The foreign policy think tanks during the election campaign informally indicated that they also face a very difficult choice. On one hand, they perceived Hillary Clinton as a Cold War warrior, and it was expected that she might even be tougher, more hawkish in the United States policy of trying to contain China or balancing towards Asia, pivoting towards the Asia-Pacific region, and so on. And on the other hand, they see Donald Trump as an unknown figure, rather unpredictable. Certainly, at this moment, Chinese leaders would like President-elect Donald Trump to realize the significance of maintaining at least a correct, if not a cordial, relationship with China, avoiding measures that would be seen as provocative towards Beijing, like labeling China as a currency manipulator, imposing duties on China's imports, and so on.
Well, Cheng also says some Chinese foreign policy analysts believe an isolationist Trump presidency will lead to a lessening of U.S. security commitments to Japan and South Korea, Beijing's regional rivals. Well, reaction in Europe to Donald Trump becoming U.S. president-elect has been mixed. Some leaders have expressed concern about what will happen to their relationships and agreements with the U.S. under a Trump administration, given his lack of foreign policy experience and detailed policies. Others, like British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, have responded positively to the Trump win. On Monday, Johnson urged people not to prejudge the president-elect and described him as a deal-maker who could be good for Britain. Catherine Field is a reporter based in Paris. She gave VOA's Laurie London an overview of the responses by other European leaders.
Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, she wrote a letter to President-elect Trump setting out what Germany expects from its future relationship with the United States. And she was very clear about that. She was clear about what great value the Germans put for people of different races, people of different cultures, for the respect for basic human rights. So that was really quite a firm assertion by Angela Merkel of that. The French president also was very clear. He said that France does have a very long relationship with the United States, but that there would need to be allowances made on both sides for the relationship to continue in a constructive manner. On the actual problems ahead for Europe and the future Trump administration, what they're looking for really is some sort of signal that a future President Trump will go along the same lines as Europeans thinking on key matters such as Russia, Syria, Iraq, NATO, and particularly Iran. Now, the EU feels very strongly about the Iran nuclear deal. The European Union worked hard in that case to broker that deal. They feel that there's a lot at stake, and the United States can't walk away from that. When it comes to Syria, you have to remember that the United Kingdom, France, and Germany really did defend the Syrian opposition, and they have been continuously calling for President Assad to step aside. So when they hear Donald Trump talking about the possibility of doing a deal with President Assad, they don't like that. Other issues which are very important to the Europeans, and particularly the French, is the Paris Agreement, that global climate accord which was signed here in Paris. That was meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and provide a more secure future for the generations to come. Now, France is really attached to that, and so are the Germans, and they don't see and don't want to see any pulling back from commitments that the Obama administration made to that. When it comes to NATO, you're seeing a far tougher line. The Secretary General of NATO, which is a 28-member alliance, he has warned that it's not going to be easy for Europe if the United States decides to go it alone. He has said that going it alone is not an option for Europe or for the United States. And in a really very harsh, if you like, criticism of Donald Trump, the NATO Secretary General pointed out that the only time that Article 5 of the NATO Charter, that article which calls for all members to take up the cause of another member if they're attacked, that the only time that self-defense clause has been used is when it was in support of the United States after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. On top of that, the NATO Secretary General said that NATO members would be very confused, would be very, if what he was describing as, you're uncertain if they saw America pulling away from NATO, because you have to remember that at least 1,000 European soldiers of the NATO alliance have died in Afghanistan as part of that operation that was in a direct response to the attack against the United States. So on that level, NATO is very concerned.
And we were listening there to Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Among the most mysterious objects in the universe are Lyman Alpha Blobs, or LAB. A LAB has been described as a huge cloud of hydrogen gas in distant areas of space. Since its discovery in 2000, scientists have been stumped by what causes a LAB to shine so brightly. Studying one of the largest objects found so far, a team of astronomers say they found two galaxies at the object's core that are forming stars at a rate over 100 times that of the Milky Way. Surrounding these two prolific galaxies is a swarm of smaller galaxies, which the team says appears to be an early phase in the formation of a massive galaxy cluster. It's thought all the star-making activity may be producing the UV light that illuminates the surrounding cloud of hydrogen gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. It's time for some entertainment and a new American film to tell you about. Based on a true story, the new movie Loving offers an intimate portrait of Richard and Mildred Loving, a white man and a black woman. They defied laws against interracial marriage in their native state of Virginia in 1957 and got married in neighboring Washington, D.C. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmaker and the lead actors about the love story that helped to change American society.
I'm going to build you a house right here. Our house. Would you marry me?
Richard and Mildred get married in the nation's capital.
I now pronounce you husband and wife.
But their union is illegal under the Racial Integrity Act of Virginia, where they live.
In here?
Richard!
What you doing in bed with that woman?
I'm his wife.
They are arrested, accused, and found guilty.
Richard Perry Loving, being a white person, and Mildred Jeter, being a colored person, did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
That ain't right!
The couple has to leave Virginia or face prison. In 1958, they moved to Washington, D.C., away from friends and family. 5 years later, in 1963, inspired by the civil rights movement, Mildred writes to U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy asking for help. She is then contacted by the Washington chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
I believe this is a court battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Filmmaker Jeff Nichols relied on historical footage and an in-depth documentary about the couple.
I can take care of you.
I know that.
But the film's power lies in the way Nichols portrays a nuanced, deep love between two people whose only desire is to live a life together. In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor. Loving versus Virginia became a landmark case that overturned miscegenation laws around the country. At the recently inaugurated African American Museum in Washington, D.C., Jeff Nichols spoke to VOA about the Oscar buzz his film has generated.
So it's flattering and humbling, but what's important here is the story we're trying to tell, Richard and Mildred's story. I didn't know about it in 2012 when I first heard about it, and that's shameful. This is a fundamental part of our American history.
You think you'll lose?
We may lose the small battles, but win the big war.
Actress Ruth Negga pours her heart into the character of Mildred. Her soulful performance has earned her acclaim. She told VOA what really inspired her to play the reluctant activist was her admiration for her character's immense courage.
How do we find out who we are, really? And usually it's when we're in peril or when we are forced to find out who we are. You know, and I think that's when our true colors show, and it's when we discover our grit and our integrity.
Asked if a film such as Loving could speak to wide audiences in America's current climate of political polarization, Joel Edgerton, who plays Richard Loving, told VOA.
We keep running into the same problems. They'll always be there, and so it's always good to have new stories and sometimes gentle stories that allow us to take a walk, an empathetic walk in someone else's shoes. And I think it's a very special film that will resonate.
Is there anything you'd like me to say to them? And by them, I mean the Supreme Court justices of the United States?
Tell the judge I love my wife.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. A programming note for you, President Obama is giving a press conference just before departing on that foreign trip, as we told you earlier in the show. You can listen to that news conference live on this audio stream. We'll be starting that at 3:15 p.m. Eastern Time or 20:15 Universal Time. Your director for today's show was Patrice Martin, and the engineer was Mark Ferguson. My thanks to them. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to reach out to me, I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. My handle is @Michael_Lippin. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in Afghanistan since U.S.-led forces helped topple the Taliban regime 15 years ago, said Secretary of State John Kerry at a recent conference on Afghanistan.
Since 2001, maternal mortality in childbirth in Afghanistan has gone down by 75%. Average life expectancy has risen from 42 years to 62 years. Access to basic health care has skyrocketed from 9% to 67%. In 2001, there was only one television station, and it was owned by the government. Now there are 75 stations, and all but two are privately owned. Back then, there were virtually no cell phones, zero. Today, there are 18 million cell phones covering about 90% of residential areas connecting Afghans to the world.
Nonetheless, despite many positive changes, the government and people of Afghanistan are still facing the same foe. Today, the Taliban are again trying to test the Afghan government's resolve, and Afghan forces continue to bravely repel these challenges, said Secretary of State Kerry. There is only one way to end this conflict, and that is through a political settlement negotiated between Taliban fighters and the Afghan government, said Secretary of State Kerry. Only through peace will Afghanistan achieve lasting stability and ultimately a full drawdown of international military forces. And the world community fully recognizes what is at stake, he said. That is why some 70 countries, including the United States, have pledged a total of $15.2 billion to support Afghanistan through the year 2020. This international support, said President Ghani, will not only help the Afghan government defeat the Taliban insurgency, but also expand its economy, fight corruption, and support human rights. The United States, said Secretary of State Kerry, pledges to deepen our strategic partnership with Afghanistan and to work with Congress to provide civilian assistance at or very near the current levels, on average, all the way through 2020. That is our financial commitment. and we expect to continue a significant, though gradually declining, level of support as Afghanistan later becomes more self-reliant through the end of the transformation decade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.